Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of the discussion of the offense in this game against the Detroit Lions on Monday night. I know a lot of people want to forget this game. I think there were actually some encouraging things that came from it. Jim Zipcode is here discussing with me. Jim, how are you doing?
Great. How are you?
I can't complain. Not too much anyway. I thought we had a nice back and forth about about Lamar's performance, about the tight ends emerging, about some receiving threats getting back into the offense in a way. We had kind of had disappearance from Zay Flowers at the same time, but Andrews, seeing Walker again make a big catch, seeing Charlie Kolar get three targets, Hopkins continue his magic. A lot of it was nice.
Yeah, and I think that kind of we've been sort of talking around the offensive line in a game where Lamar withstood a lot of pressure, kind of faced a lot of difficulty. So I think everyone would like to know how you think the offensive line performed in this game. And do you want to go left to right? Do you want to start with Ronnie Stanley?
You call it. Well, Ronnie Stanley is a great place to start usually, and it's usually is where I do it. I've got to say something has happened in our household that has really made things a little easier. And if you remember in years past, it would often be Thursday of the week before I could get the offensive line scoring published. And a lot of that had to do with Maureen's work schedule. She works very closely with me on this and does the offensive line scoring directly. In fact, if you ever tweet me at a game, if you DM me or you have a question, you just put in general Twitter and tag me about who's playing in the secondary. I always turn to Maureen and ask, who's there? Because she's the one who's actually charting it during the game, particularly when we're at the game, because you can see a lot more than we'll see on the TV copy when we get home. So that's usually the place to get that.
But the unsung hero that makes Ken's podcast work.
No, she's unbelievably good, and she's hopefully will take more responsibility with a lot of things. But she's just retired is the big new news in our house. And so we have time to work on this. And so the offensive line articles are getting produced, in the morning, 2 days after the game. It was an incredible feeling this week, because after a game like this, you kind of want to be done with the analysis as quickly as possible. And within, slightly more than maybe 37 hours after the game was complete, all of the writing and analysis had been done. So that's a very tight time frame for me.
So you can put this game behind you. I still have yet to write my piece for the Substack, so it's still very much in front of me.
You got that mountain to look ahead to. But I appreciate you making time for this show, Jim, because it is a big commitment.
Oh, it's always a thrill for me. I love being on. But enough ducking the question. How did Ronnie Stanley play in this game?
So he had a lot of trouble with Hutchinson and Muhammad as I scored it. I did notice that PFF was a lot more generous with him. I think I know the reason, so we'll talk about this. I had him as party to five negative events in this game, and that included, let me look at this here, 1.5 sacks. So I had him as one sack. He's just beaten inside cleanly by Hutchinson, but another sack, I gave him half the charge for it. And then he had three other pressures, and they were all full pressures. And it was a combination of Muhammad and Hutchinson that were beating him on that side. But he definitely struggled some. Tough game for him. A lot of those were cone pressures, which I think is the big difference from PFF. So that's times where the cone in front of the quarterback is impeded to an extent that Lamar can't confidently step into his throw in the direction of the eligible receiver to a 30-degree angle at either side to get into some of the real specifics of it. And it's just something that I felt has been a very good way to manage pressure. And it usually is highly indicated when the quarterback takes anything less than a full step to throw. So if he's throwing off his back foot from in the pocket, it's usually because the cone is impeded and that ball is much more at risk. So I call those pressures and assign them to the lineman. PFF, I know, does not in all cases. And whenever we've looked at things, and PFF is very open about how they score things,
right,
we'll see definitional differences like that showing up where I'll call it a pressure because the cone is impeded.
That's interesting, right? The way the procedure, just the procedural analysis of these things go.
Yeah. So there's almost all models. First of all, if everybody had the exact same model of how to score offensive line, boy, would the work be boring, because we just all be repeating each other's experiments and making sure we were right. In the way we do it, you can actually learn different things from the different models. They tell you different pieces of information. I think that's what makes this a lot more interesting to me. And just something fun. I know it's something my dad told me about, not really wanting to repeat somebody else's experiment. You always wanted to try something that was new and outside the norm of what had been done in the lab before. And that was kind of a cool thing.
Was that Stanley's worst game in a while?
I thought he had an F earlier this year, but he had already had one bad game this year. I think he did have a kind of a high F, but let me check. Stanley had a minus in the first game against Buffalo, then an F against Cleveland, where he got beat by Myles Garrett pretty badly. A penetration, two pressures, a third of a quarterback hit, and two sacks in that game. And then a sack and a half in this game with three pressures. The last game against Garrett, even with adjustment, he was at 0.48. This game, he was at 0.63 after adjustments. It was a D. So not a complete fall off the table game by any standards. You know, there's a fair number of Ds occur during the regular season. I think his play was clearly above the replacement level, or marginally above the replacement level, I would say, in this game. He did have a tough assignment. He also, in addition to the five plays, he was also run out of one pressure by Lamar, which was kind of a twin pressure with, I think it was him and Faalele, each gave up what I score as a zero R, where he effectively gets charged for half of that pressure inside his subjective adjustment. So if you want to look a little bit inside into the weeds in terms of what that happened. So not a good game from Stanley. He's had worse. At least it was a tough opponent, but he's now had two tough opponents in a row where he's had a lot of struggles.
Yeah. How was Voorhees?
So improvement for Voorhees. He played all 54 scored snaps as well. 48 blocks, four missed. The four missed total is good, by the way. That's a nice low total for him, for any guard, I'd say. But he'd had 18 missed blocks combined in the first two games in only 100 snaps. So that was a significant portion of his total deductions. And he did give up. I gave him 1/6 of one of the sacks. And you know, the rule is I have to give out fractionally the credit for one sack among whatever players are deserving of that sack. And so he got 1/6 in his case, and Stanley got a half, and somebody else got a third. I'm not sure who it was right at this time, but might've been Rosengarten. And then there was half a pressure he gave up as well. So he scored 46 points on 54 plays, and with a adjustment that keeps him in the B range in this game, which is by far his best game of the year. His previous two games combined, he'd been 3 points below a passing grade.
Okay.
So, and to put that in terms people can really understand, at no point during the 2024 season, when Daniel Faalele had a pretty terrible, piss poor first 14 games, was Daniel Faalele ever as bad on an aggregate basis over a two game stretch. There's not any time when he was as bad. So, this was just big bounce back game from Voorhees, and he's bought himself a little leash, I think.
That's terrific. If there's one really kind of positive sign, the idea that one of the guards could be, you know, improving, you know, solidifying his play is encouraging. What how'd the center do? How was Linderbaum?
So Linderbaum had been mediocre the first two games. He had, I think, a C and might have been a C and a D minus, in fact, in the two games. So not up to Linderbaum's normal standards. This game was a B. He was pretty good. There was a jailbreak sack that he got 1/3 of. I think it went 1/3 to each of the three players on the right side, if I recall. But Linderbaum got his face crossed by Muhammad. PFF gave him the entire sack on the play, and I split it three ways between him, Faalele, and Rosengarten, because I thought it really was pressure that phone booth the pocket basically from that entire right side, and each player had contributed something negative to that play.
Jailbreak is exactly right. It just looked ridiculous. Lamar was, you know, had no prayer.
Yeah. And but Faalele, you know, decent
Linderbaum,
marginal,
I think we're still
Linderbaum, yeah. Thank you for redirecting me. Only had one missed block in the game. So that's really good. So when you're a center, you're supposed to know who you're going to block, and they tend to have the lowest missed block totals. So that was good. He had two level two blocks. He didn't do anything else in terms of having a pancake. He wasn't asked to pull on any plays. Let me confirm that's true. Yeah, or have a highlight. So he didn't have any of those. There's very precious little level two blocking in this game. The Lions were too quick getting in gaps, coming downhill to stop runs. The Ravens didn't really have the opportunity to have linemen climb as often as they typically do in a game they play and that they're really dominating. So anyway, Linderbaum, a good game. It's really good to see him have a a little bit better pass blocking game and a good game otherwise in terms of not missing blocks in the run game. He's already pretty much was doing that. The problem is the high weight, the high value thing, he wasn't doing well, and he did improve, I think, slightly in that category this week.
So that's a B for the game?
B for the game.
All right. And everyone's favorite punching bag, everyone's favorite target, big Daniel Fa'alele. How did he do?
He's, you know, okay, first of all, PFF has Fa'alele graded 19th among all guards in aggregate score. I don't think that's too far off what I would say. I might be a little bit lower. I might even be a little bit higher if I scored all the linemen in the league by my method, but I don't think that's too far off. And it's, and you know, that's like 19th out of 64 roughly who've had 100 snaps. So he's in the top third. It shouldn't surprise anybody at this point, but there's still so many people that want to focus on, but I saw this one clip, but I saw this one. And I can just tell you, that's what it was like trying to talk baseball with people in the 1970s and early 1980s before sabermetrics came along. They wanted to talk to you about the one great fielding play they'd seen from a player.
Right.
But I once saw this play where he went far to his right and then he threw to first and he got the guy out. Yeah, okay, fine.
Or I saw one error, which was the one error he committed, you know, in the last 10 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah,
you. So I think that the problem with Fa'alele is always that his failures, his losses are just ugly, just so ugly. And it reminds me of 2018 Lamar, who would please shoot me the next time I try to liken these two guys to each other. What a dumb thing to say. But if you go back to 2018 Lamar, like, he would have dropbacks where he would, you know, a defender would tug on his jersey and he would reset his feet and keep his eyes downfield. He would go through progressions. He would hit guys in the second window. He would throw with anticipation. But then he would dirt a ball 6 yards in front, you know, of a guy on an easy swing pass. And so he had a situation where he was making the difficult plays and failing in an ugly way on the easy plays, and people wanted to chuck him after 2018. And I think Fa'alele, I don't want to go too far down the idea that Fa'alele is similar to Lamar, but I think that his failures are ugly, as Lamar's 2018 failures were ugly, and they trigger something in people that make them go, that guy cannot play.
Right. I think that's exactly right. I mean, he has a kind of a Herman Munster-esque quality in his movement out there where he's kind of plodding around. And anybody who's ever seen the Herman Munster episodes where he's playing sports, he's, you know, the greatest athlete you've ever seen kind of thing. But he's a lumbering athlete, and he, you know, his quickness will always be something the Ravens have to kind of scheme around. But he does a lot of things really well. And the big things he does well is he's not penalized, although I got to figure out where that one is.
Right.
And he's been a good pass blocker, generally speaking. And this year, actually, he's missed relatively few blocks. So I don't, not tremendously few, but, you know, relative to last year, he's missed, I can relativize this. He's missed 16 blocks in 154 snaps. So do that for me really quickly, what that is. And I'll look up his last year here.
Sure.
I know you're a guy who always has a calculator around. let's see if I've got the 2024 offensive line scoring by game. Let's go back and look at this really quick. This is like such a faux pas to do this while we're on air, but I don't care. I don't care.
So we all last have our year, own ways to deal with a tough loss.
Yeah, so last year he had 141 missed blocks in 1159.
So 141 over 1159. So the other figure was 10.4%, and last year's figure was 12.2%.
Yeah. So a substantial improvement. You know, it's probably a 15% reduction, 16% reduction in terms of his missed blocks. I don't want to overstate the importance of it, but it's a slight improvement. The pressures, he's given up more of them than he did. The week two game honestly really looked like it was completely in line with the last five games of last season. The first game made you worried because it was a D and it was below where he had been. And then this last game is in between. So I still don't think we exactly know who he is as a player, but he's like Voorhees. He's earned himself more leash, I believe, with this game. A solid C game is not going to get him yanked in terms of what's happening right now. And that's, you know, despite the fact that the Rome is burning around him, in a lot of ways with this offensive line, he's in a lot of ways, you know, is not the problem at all. He's got a 75 aggregate score for the year. That would, you know, work out to be a solid C, maybe even a high C in terms of what he's done for the year so far.
Interesting. How about Rosengarten?
All right. So Rosengarten had the toughest, one of the tougher games on the offensive line. So he faced Hutchinson a lot, gave up a lot of his pressure events to him. But let's see. Looking at Rosengarten, he had 54 plays, made 44 of his blocks, but he had a total of 6 different pressure events. Now, this breaks down in an odd way. He had 2 pressures, a half a pressure, and a quarter of a pressure. So that's 2.75 pressures. And then he had 2 times a third of a sack. So he had 2/3 of a sack in the game. Worked out to be a 0.64. I did give him a big adjustment for basically playing a lot against Hutchinson. And he ends up with a C- on the game and 4 level 2 blocks and 4 pancakes in the game. So he led the team in pancakes, and he also led the team in level 2 blocks. He's one of the only players to be able to do that. His highlight was a really nice combination block on the Henry 28-yard touchdown run. So he made a very nice help at the line of scrimmage, moved to level 2, made his block, and that really helped Henry go the rest of the way.
What if you had to back up and look at Rosengarten long-term, like over the last, you know, the 3 games you've seen this season and the second half of last season, what do you think of how he's progressing as a player?
Yeah, so one thing I didn't do this game was really try and split into L's and R's what was going on, but there's been less help for him on the right side this year than there had been at last year. I'm kind of looking at this qualitatively, 34 of these notations down on the sheet. I would not say it's heavily one direction or the other. I think there's a lot of L's. It does seem like maybe a slight preponderance of R's, if I had to say, in this game. That's where Hutchinson is. I'm not really surprised by it. Last week, I wouldn't have been surprised if it was more on the left side, because that's where Garrett was. So, I think it's a lot opponent dependent, and they're trying to figure it out as they go. They also had a bunch of guys setting up in the middle to protect against potential delayed blitzes in this game. So
okay,
they had some M's for that. But anyway, I think your real question is, do we think we'll still think Rosengarten can move to left tackle someday? Is that really
what you're... No, I don't. I want to know if he can develop into something close to a Pro Bowl level right tackle.
Still very early in his career.
Yep.
You can see from last year, in terms of he was better than any rookie tackle other than Joe Alt, that he was already well ahead of the curve in terms of what was going on. Whatever caveats you want to throw on that, I mean, you know, you'd rather have him than a lot of the other guys that were out there, including Kingsley Suamataia, who was one of my favorites. Talk to the Chiefs Know Your Foe guy, by the way, and listen for that episode. It'll be out tomorrow. But he was a very pro Suamataia guy either. And so it was interesting to hear two pro Suamataia people kind of confessing their sins to each other in terms of the draft. That's what it felt like a little bit. But anyway, in terms of Rosengarten, you know, he started at the top. I think this season, it's hard to really get a gauge yet, but he's right in the C range through 3 games.
Tough opponents.
Tough opponents. Maybe a C- actually, now that I look at it. But still, I mean, I think he's at a position where he could be as good as he is last year. As he was last year, you'd hope for a little bit of growth, but he might be as good as he was last year with less help. I think that's what it might be.
Which actually is positive.
Yeah.
So I'm struck looking at the grades overall that we think of Ravens fandom, we think of the tackles as being fairly solid and the interior being the questionable area. And it looks like comparatively the interior played fairly well this game.
Yeah.
And the tackles not so much.
Yeah, they did. I mean, again, the real quality of their pass rush is on the edge. Their interior guys, they aren't bad. I mean, they've got DJ Reader inside. He's a guy who certainly earlier in his career gave the Ravens all kinds of problems. He's probably not quite the same player anymore. Right. Physically, he looks the part of a nose tackle. He looks, you know, like he's not quite at Michael Pierce's weight, but he's carrying a lot of spare change with him there. Their defensive front was good. And the other thing that kind of made this not all about the offensive line was that the Lions were finding ways to get other people in the backfield, and they were making very effective use of that spy to control Lamar's movements towards the line of scrimmage. and keep the sack in order. And some of the, I think one of them was the spy that made the sack, but other ones, it was somebody else arriving late because Lamar was kind of trapped with a spy there.
Yeah. Just an interesting game. I think the Lions looked so vigorous and quick and physical and so much more so on both lines that the Ravens did, that it was really kind of depressing to think of. You know, I certainly had the Ravens as a Super Bowl favorite going into this game. So it's easy to overreact, right? The both seasons that the Ravens won the Super Bowl, they went through stretches where they looked like they shouldn't even be in the playoffs, right? Like, right, the whole month of October without scoring a touchdown in 2000, was it a 5-game losing streak to end 2012? And they fired their offensive coordinator, and you know, they looked a mess, right? And so I would say in both of the Super Bowl winning years, the Ravens looked worse then at their nadir, right, than they look after this Monday night loss. So I don't, you know, as I overreact, I am also trying to catch myself against that overreaction.
Right. I would agree with that. And I think, you know, the big thing that's on the line this week against Kansas City,
yeah,
is any remaining hope of the number two seed.
Yes.
This is a very high value game.
Yes.
But I don't think that the Ravens become a prohibitive favorite by any stretch to win the division if they lose this game and even start off 1-3. I think that they still have a pretty darn good chance to win the division. They'll have all of their divisional games, with the exception of the one Cleveland game they've already won,
which is win in hand. Yeah.
Yeah. To do well. I think that other teams may have some problems with Cleveland. I think Cleveland may end up winning, as John Harbaugh says, a bunch of games. And whether he means a bunch is 6-8, even that would be so far ahead of expectations. Mm-hmm. I would also think, by the way, as an aside, I think it'd be a very good thing if Cleveland were able to win 8 games, go 8-9, because I think that's what keeps them from getting the quarterback they really need.
Yes.
Yeah. So if they end up drafting 13th, and they also have the pick from last year, and they try and use that to trade up, they may either have to trade 3-for-1, including a pick from a future year, maybe even 2, to trade 4-for-1 to get one of the top 2 picks to get the quarterback they want. Or they might have to settle for somebody they'll get at the 13th pick and hopefully just judge it wrong. Now, they already got Baker Mayfield. Yes. Might have had the right guy.
Right.
Didn't give him the proper amount of leash and class him off to the NFC, where he's been a hell of a player.
Right. So even them drafting the right guy is absolutely no guarantee. But their draft class, they've got, what, 3 good-looking rookies? Yeah. Yeah. So I would agree with you. And I had not thought of that. The other thing that I would say, that, you know, if the Browns were to win 8 or 9 games, that could be a positive, because some of those are going to come against divisional opponents. You know, they can take down the Steelers anytime they want to. And I wouldn't mind the Bengals getting a couple extra losses either.
Yeah. Bengals are another team I don't really want getting a super high pick, but they just used number 17 overall on Shamar Stewart. So that was a pick I didn't have any respect for.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just what it is. All right. I guess we've gone through the offensive line. Let me go back to the outline here, and we'll
going. I do want to ask you more about the offensive line. So I tried to pin you down on Rosengarten. Do you still see a bright future for him? Did you ever see a bright future, and do you still see one?
Okay, so on draft night, I would have said they drafted the wrong guy. I would have rather had Kingsley. So I was completely wrong about that.
Okay.
And then, you know, it proved out from his first year that he really outplayed the other tackles, with the exception of Ault, who was the 5th overall pick or whatever it was. So from that standpoint, he's already outperformed expectations. But I think the real question is the one I kind of posed myself, which is, will he ever move to left tackle? I don't think that's in the cards. I think Carson Vinson is the more likely next left tackle for the Ravens than Rosengarten, even though he's not a sure thing either. But at least we've seen him play exclusively left tackle.
Right.
And Vincent also is a guy who is left tackle or nothing based on his frame, whereas Rosengarten, I think, potentially could play either.
Okay.
So I think, you know, he's shown enough mobility. We saw some of that in this game, that I kind of like him as a right tackle anyway. I think he gives you a little more chance to get that seal block on the outside of a right-handed run. Most of the pulling that the Ravens do goes from left to right. They're not going to be pulling, obviously, now or really now, I guess, with Daniel Faalele. I know Ravens fans would be really upset about this, but let me ask you, Jim, How upset would you be if they signed Daniel Faalele mid-season for 3 years for $13 million?
I would be performatively outraged. Like, how dare they spend the money when they don't have a good edge rusher or whatever. But in terms of, you know what? I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I wouldn't be thrilled. I can see the logic to it. You've got an adequate starter at a cheap salary, you know, lock him up. I wouldn't be thrilled, but I would see the logic.
Okay. And I think it'd be very similar in a lot of ways to the contract they gave James Hurst, where they, I think it was 4 years, $17 million for him. So in present value cap dollars, it'd be a lot less than that. And you'd be paying for a guard instead of a potential tackle. They did use Hurst at tackle for a portion of that period. I could really see it. And I'm not even sure Faalele would sign for anything like that. I think his agent may tell him play out the season and you'll get a better offer somewhere else. And anyone looking at the PFF charts and making any GM doing that and making the choices based on that, who basically is not a GM, is going to live in the National Football League for very long, by the way.
Right.
But anyone who's doing that is going to, or who uses it even as a corroborative factor, is going to think that Faalele is a guy that we think we can help make into a better player than he's been in Baltimore.
I would like to know something that is unknowable at this moment, which is how good of an offensive line coach is George Warhop?
Yeah.
And like, I know that last year he stepped into extremely difficult circumstances. I know that I felt that Joe D was an excellent offensive line coach. I felt that the Ravens under him played very cohesive. You got very cohesive play from the O-line, from O-lines that were often not very talented. So I think that on the whole, I think that those lines played at or maybe a little over their talent level. I don't know that I would want to back that up if you pushed me on that. But I would like to know how good George Warhop is. And so kind of that's an underlying theme when I ask you about Voorhees or what you think of Rosengarten. You know, like I'm just grasping for like little shreds, little bits of bark or mulch of evidence.
The thing I would point to is last year, the point of emphasis made to improve penalties in the second half was extreme and very successful. And the light switch went on basically at the exact same time they were coincidentally making the change at safety and the defense got their act together. Mm-hmm. But the offensive line, all of a sudden they, you know, three or four of the five guys completely shut the penalty faucet off, mm-hmm. which had been pretty bad at that point, including McCary and Faalele in that group.
Well, that's around what, game 10 or so?
Yeah. Game 10. Yeah.
That's significant. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about some skill position players here. And we've hit on some of them, but whatever depth you'd like to go into, Jim, you're the guest. Who would you like to talk about first?
I would like to talk about Mr. Rashad Bateman finally showing up in a game for the Ravens this year. He had been kind of MIA, but he, in this game, he had an explosive play. He had a quality start, which I define as a game with 3+ catches and 7+ yards per target. 7 targets, 5 receptions for 63 yards. Honestly, I kind of want to credit him with one of those targets and call it 6 targets because one of them was not catchable. Also had a touchdown. And that was his first good game since last January, week 17 against the Browns, which the Ravens won 35-10. He had 76 yards and a touchdown in that game too. So this was his first game in really 4 games that was good.
Do you have I realize you may not have this, and I could probably scan it down really quickly looking at the GSIS site, but do you have how many quality starts that Bateman had all of last year?
Yes, I do. But you could talk a little bit to fill the void while I'm looking up.
I'll give you my thoughts on Bateman from this game.
Okay.
So I still don't think we've seen Bateman, the home run hitter this year with Lamar. And so we've seen some of that from Walker. Walker has really taken over some of that responsibility. We've also seen some of it from Hopkins. Both those guys have outrageous yards per target numbers. Bateman's are low, and Bateman is probably doing more of the possession work, and he's probably also doing a disproportionate amount of the extension of the run game throws. Not the quick outs in those, but some of the slant work he's done and some of the others. So it looks like you might have the number.
I do. So Bateman was third in quality starts last year with only 6. So Mark Andrews and Zay Flowers both had 9. and then Bateman had six, and Isaiah Likely had four.
That's interesting. I'd like to see kind of around the league how, I mean, it's probably doable with Stathead, because you can do targets and you do your yards per target.
Yes.
On Stathead. So you could do it for the season and see who had the most games in 2025 only of this type and get a leaderboard. That'd be interesting to see for the entire NFL.
Yeah, what I think you're really going to see is that the stars, the guys who are like the fantasy football number ones and stuff, they almost always have a quality start, right? So right. It's really kind of the mid-tier receivers who start to but the Ravens don't throw as much mm-hmm. as other teams do. So it's actually kind of difficult for multiple players to rack up QSs for the Ravens.
So maybe it even should be target share and yards per target is the way you define it. And that gives a player like Bateman a little bit better chance if you normalize the target shares by team kind of thing.
Bateman is in an interesting position, I think, in this offense. Exactly as you say, they use him. Like, I think that he would be ideal in like a Keenan Allen kind of role, which is like a high target volume, kind of nearish to the line of scrimmage, mm-hmm. but the Ravens have their tight ends. So, you know, their need for him is deeper. But the Ravens, this year's Ravens, have Zay Flowers, DeAndre Hopkins, and the emerging Tez Walker. You know, so I feel like Bateman is getting squeezed, his opportunity set, sort of from both kind of ends of the target depth range.
Right. He can make his money as a pure X. He gets a lot of the space budget on that side. He can run a lot of different routes on that side to try and get free. And he can use the wiggle. And if they're not paying attention to him with a safety, he can certifiably burn a corner deep once in a while and have Lamar hopefully hit him on one of those. But we really haven't seen that in three games. We haven't really seen a good deep ball to Bateman. Remember a couple of years ago, the argument was that Bateman didn't really have Lamar's.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything. Data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove. Trust, and that's why he was getting massively overthrown on a lot of the deep balls mm-hmm. that were there.
Yeah,
that has not been a problem with DeAndre Hopkins this year. You right. just basically throw it up to wherever those two guys are plastered to each other, and Hopkins will go get the ball.
Yeah, I think I know that many fans have been arguing this for years, but a Hopkins-like receiver for Lamar early on, I think, would have really kind of accelerated his development. Just a guy that he could. I know he's always used Andrews as a guy that he trusts in contested catch situations, but a wide receiver that he would trust in contested catch situations is just a huge addition.
Yeah, it's a much bigger addition because Andrews is typically going to be open on a shorter route when contested. It's usually going to be between level two and three. There are plenty of times here where he's the guy who says, you know, waves to Lamar, he's going deep, or Lamar waves him deep. Or they just both think it at the same time and he gets to the right spot. But yeah, I agree. So I'd like to see a little bit different, a little bit more incorporation of Bateman, but at least they got him the ball some. And I think they actually were scheming it to him some in this game to try and, you know, get him rolling. Kind of like, you know, you get your big man rolling in basketball when you need to, and he's a freshman.
Right.
You might only have him for that year anyway.
Monken is really interesting in the sense that he uses everybody. Like, he really uses all those guys as targets, which is not something that Greg Roman typically did.
Well, the one guy he hasn't had in the offense, I'll talk about really briefly here, is LaJonte Wester. And I don't know that Wester has played an offensive snap this year. He may have played none. Mm-hmm. I have two game books up in front of me. I'll just check this really quick. But no, Wester did not have an offensive snap in this game, in the Cleveland game. I don't believe he had an offensive snap, but I know he had three. Okay. I'd like to see them have a package of plays. Probably was in at the end of the game when Cooper Rush was in at quarterback, by the way. He was in for three kneels. It wasn't three actual plays.
Oh, right.
But I would like to see more of LaJonte Wester, you know, used on some of the gadget plays, at least try and figure out if there's a magic there. What we saw in the preseason on punt returns, the unbelievable ability to avoid people in a small space is a rare, rare gift. Jermaine Lewis had it. Mm-hmm. He seems to have it. It's got to be translatable to offense. And you look back to Jermaine Lewis's career on offense, it was no trivial thing. In 1998, I mean, he had five plays over 50 yards that year. You can definitely get a high quality performance out of a relatively low utilization player like Wester, if you're willing to create a package of plays for him. And it doesn't have to be a package of plays for him, like in the sense that we always know he's getting the ball if he's in the field. Right. It's just a package of plays
where he's an element of. Yeah. So, right. But, you know, so I agree with you, but the counter argument I think would be, like, first of all, you're taking snaps away from someone among Zay Flowers and DeAndre Hopkins and Rashad Bateman and Tez Walker and punt return Tay. Who am I missing? Number 16.
Tylan Wallace.
And none of the games that the Ravens have played so far, none of the matchups have really lent themselves to an experimental mood, right? Like, the Bills game was way too important. The divisional opponent coming off of an 0-1 start, you know, the Detroit Lions coming to town next week, the Chiefs, you know, like, at some point, I guess we'll have a cupcake game at home, which would be like an ideal time to roll out a package, but not so far.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm with you on that. I think he's it's certainly like giving a start to your eighth best starting pitcher during the regular season. You know, it's not just something you often have an opportunity to do.
Yeah. Did you have a skill player you wanted to discuss?
I actually just brought up Wester, so I think it's your turn again.
Oh, it's my turn. Mark Andrews. Welcome back, Mark Andrews. It's great to see the emergence of tight end number one. It's interesting. This is two seasons in a row he's gotten off to a slow start. Last year, we suspected injury due to the car crash, and he was really kind of a non-performer for the first 4 weeks of the season. And then he came on to post some of the best stats of any tight end in the league over the remainder of the year. So in Monday night's game, he was six catches on six targets for 91 yards, which is over 15 yards per target. Definitely a quality start. He had two touchdowns and an explosive play, which is a play of 20 or more yards. And just his, we talk about some players being like the heart and soul of the offense or whatever. There is something about his ferocity when he catches big passes and spikes the ball and stomps around that I do believe has a bit of an energizing effect on the team.
Yeah, he's definitely a big positive. It was making the Ravens roster decisions after the season maybe a little easier if Andrews
if he was declining.
Yeah, was declining, it would have made the choice easy. Now is a big question again. And you know, they've got three tight ends and they've also got Ricard. I honestly think the Ricard decision is getting easier by the week. That's the sad thing about this. I mean, just injuries of this age. And Ricard's, he's beaten the dice so many times on injuries ending his career with both hips, you know, having problems and you know, numerous other problems. The guy's tough as nails. He comes back from it and he makes great blocks. And he's been a very valuable player. It just may be the end. I mean, you know, the end came for Justin Tucker, for Ed Reed, for lots of players. Setting aside the off-field activities of Justin Tucker, the on-field activities of Justin Tucker were flagging the end before the off-field activities got up for sure.
I'm curious. So you've brought up two things and I want to talk about them simultaneously, but let's not talk about the first one, which is whether you think Justin Tucker makes a comeback this year with another team. But Patrick Ricard is, he'll be 32 next year. And, you know, he's had a long and distinguished career, but like he's in a declining position, right? With a very kind of a narrow upside or limited upside to begin with. Mm-hmm. And he's aging. Like you got to think that they'll be looking to move on from him, right?
I think so. The thing that will tell you is giving Ricard probably the best ray of hope for, say, recovering next year, being healthy again and getting another shot with the Ravens is the fact of how lousy the Ravens runs game has been without him.
True.
I mean, it's just, you know, when you see that, even with some good defenses, some packed boxes and whatnot, I still say it's great. Patrick Ricard's agent and himself, for that matter, have got to be thinking this can't hurt me. What's happened while it's being out? And I'm sure he doesn't want to see the Ravens losing. I'll ascribe that behavior to his agent.
It's funny you talk about Ricard in the run blocking. It's not funny. It's a standard usage for fullback, right? But the thing that has always really struck me about Ricard is since the beginning of 2023 is how effective he's been as a pass blocker in weird situations. You know, like he switches on to Myles Garrett and blocks him effectively. Like he just really, to me, he really shows up as a pass blocker a lot in kind of desperate situations.
Yeah, when he's asked to make a pass block, it is typically a difficult one. Mm-hmm. So he'll typically be on the edge trying to make a quality chip block or a quality set block, either one, against a tough pass rusher. And I don't think that's maybe completely reflected in what we see from like PFF score of him. But it's, I think he's, you know, he's a highly valuable and yet a dubious, you know, alchemical component for the Ravens offense that it's really hard to understand exactly how valuable he is to this team. But the best way to see it is that they're not running the ball effectively for the first time in a very long time without him.
Among the many reasons I would like to see this year's Ravens win a Super Bowl, you know, and there's no shortage of those reasons, but it would be nice to see this addition, like these guys who have, you know, like Mark Andrews, who might move on after the season, Patrick Ricard, who might move on after the season, like players who have really given a lot to the success of the last, you know, six, seven years worth of Ravens teams and have meant a lot to them. It would be nice to see them get one.
I'm trying to think of the other multiple contract players. There's obviously, you know, all the guys, Owe and likely Stanley and Linderbaum and Travis Jones, who are at risk of not being Ravens next year. But there'd be other guys. Broderick Washington may be done with the Ravens after this year. And if that were the case, you know, he'd be a guy who nobody's thinking about in terms of, boy, would it be nice for him to win the Super Bowl here in Baltimore. But this might be his last chance.
Yeah.
Anywhere. All right. Is it
your turn for a skill position player?
Let's talk about DeAndre Hopkins a little bit, because the ability of him is just, he's not the kind of separation guy that even OBJ was when he was here a couple of years ago. He's a non-separation player at this point, but he has a couple of OBJ-esque qualities. And one is he can go find the football and
he can track that football.
Tracks it very well. And the other thing is he definitely has tremendous veteran savvy in terms of initiating and getting penalty calls. Mm-hmm. And the one I really remember from OBJ was him pulling a defender down on top of him, which could be seen from the review. but he gets the penalty call as he's being
throwing his hands up as he felt like, ah, what's happening? It's
Moses Malone-esque in terms of his ability to draw fouls. And we saw one from Hopkins, I thought, where the Hopkins-Arnold interaction on that left sideline in the Monday night game was somewhat similar. It looked like both players were kind of jacking each other a little bit. Mm-hmm. Arnold did have a little piece of jersey, which might have been reactive to the initial shove from Hopkins. But yeah, that's what got seen. And sometimes it's a guy who makes the second shove in a fight who gets the penalty for it. So Hopkins has been obviously a terrific asset support, much far north of what I think anybody could have reasonably expected of him, even though he's only got four targets. Still four targets, right? For a ton of yards.
Yeah.
60 or more yards, a couple touchdowns.
No, you're talking about in the versus the Lions, or you mean total?
No, Hopkins, I'm sorry, has six targets for 112 yards. So he's averaging over 18.7 yards per target, which
that's right.
I think you mentioned is the high in the National Football League for
the high in the National Football League, and his 12.44 YTS, which is success rate times yards per target, also a high. And I, through the first two games, now I didn't check to see his snap count against the Lions.
I'll check it for you while you're doing this.
Well, I think I loved the way the Ravens 14. Used him. 14. So he had 14 in game one. No, he averaged 14 through the first two games, 18 in game one, 10 in game two, 14 again this season. So he's averaging 14 snaps a game. I love that in terms of the usage of him. I think that's absolutely perfect in terms of workload, you know, for a 32-year-old receiver, keeping him, you know, effective and productive and maximizing his snaps while not wearing him down. That's top notch as far as I'm concerned.
I agree completely. And the guy who's been surprisingly getting many more snaps than people probably realize is Wallace. Wallace has gotten 60 snaps combined in the last two games. Mm. Whereas Walker, we see him making play after play after play,
right,
had seven snaps this last game. In the previous game, he had 13. So he's been used, I'm pretty sure, less than Hopkins through three games.
Yeah.
20 snaps the last two.
Yeah. It's interesting. So I mean, I would imagine that if Tez Walker keeps making plays every game, I would imagine that his snap count would ramp up over the course of the year.
I would too. I would expect him to outsnap Hopkins if he continues on the kind of trajectory he's had with it doesn't even have to be that good, honestly, because it almost can't be.
It can't be.
But if he continues to be able to get open on deep routes, and probably that's going to require him to do more coming back to the quarterback as well. Mm-hmm. He did in that Dallas preseason game where he had a whole bunch of comeback and short intermediate stuff where they really tried to scheme for that. I want to see that during the regular season too, is him making a couple nice comeback throws in addition to, you know, the couple of nice corner routes we've seen, the touchdown and the long one in this game as well.
So let me get this straight. You're thinking that him catching absolutely everything that's thrown to him to the tune of 20 yards per target, you think that's not sustainable? Is that
that's what I'm saying.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, probably increase that target total. I'm sure everybody within range of my voice probably knows that the big play for however long it was in this game, 34 yards, was his first non-touchdown of his career.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So there's real value though in a deep threat, like just a guy who is a deep threat, like a take the lid off the defense, and he's got that in spades.
Yeah, he's I love having a deep threat. He's got to have something to be able to sell that and exploit the leverage he creates against an opposing corner.
To turn into a fully rounded receiver, he does, but he still adds value to the offense just doing that.
There may be some gravitational value you get, but you definitely get a lot less if all he does is run straight down the field, even if there's a post or corner component of that that is going in one direction or the other to gain a leverage advantage as well. But you get some gravitational pull from a safety out of a player like Walker. Mm-hmm. I think that's fair to say. And hopefully that's something that will continue. When they have single high, he's a really outstanding weapon. I mean, he's a guy that a single high safety cannot be involved in covering Tez Walker running down the field on a corner or a nine. It can be a factor and that's from the X. Let me be clear.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Does the X run? Yeah, there's one route that I think of as the Mark Andrews route, which is that deep over. Is that something that a perimeter player, like a boundary player, like an X usually runs, or is that strictly a slot kind of route?
No, it can. The primary place where you see a deep over run by an X receiver is if you have zone block left, naked boot right, where you're using a levels concept. And the three places where you get your receivers are you get your tight end, who usually makes an initial chip at the line of scrimmage on the edge defender to kind of distract him from the quarterback, then runs out to level zero and hope right at the line of scrimmage to be the worst option of the three. Mm-hmm. And then your intermediate option is the deep over, usually coming from the X receiver on the other side.
Okay.
And then your deep option is the straight go or possibly a post route
from the Y
run by the run
or
by
the Z rather on the
side. Yeah, I guess it could be either the Z or the Y on that side.
But from the side that you are booting to.
But side you're booting to, that's correct.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where some of the great long pass interference play penalties from Joe Flacco to Torrey Smith were drawn. Joe Flacco, 1 year, and this was, I think this was 2012, but it might have been 2011, had the three longest pass interference plays in the entire National Football League, and they're all on similar plays, 50, 50, and 60 yards. Think about a 60-yard pass interference penalty, just how monstrous a throw that has to be for the corner to make contact at 60 yards to keep Torrey Smith from trying to catch that ball.
So Tez Walker on that deep over, I can see him making that play all day, just with the speed to separate left to right.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think he'd be deadly there. Flowers obviously would be very deadly in that in that position as well.
Yep.
The Ravens don't run boot too much of that type because all eyes are on Lamar Jackson. So that edge defender, his antenna are already up to watch for Jackson to get out of the pocket to the right. And he has to be right on that. If it were Joe Flacco, less mobile quarterback, actually it's an easier play to fool the defense.
Yeah. That's interesting. Right. Because that backside defender is already staying home. Like the threat of the boot is already built into every handoff Lamar makes.
Yeah. He has to be every zone block play that goes to the left or to the right for that matter. The backside edge defender needs to be very careful not to over pursue with the risk of Jackson doing what he can do. All right. Anybody else you want to talk about?
Not really. We probably should say something about Zay Flowers just because it was such a low, two catches for 13 yards on three targets. I assume, but I did not look at the all 22 to verify, that the Lions were kind of rolling coverage to him and trying to take Zay Flowers away to make Lamar throw to the other players, which he did quite successfully to Mark Andrews and Rashad Bateman. But, that's just an assumption. I haven't backed that up with anything.
Right. And I didn't diagnose that specifically. It's really something I probably should have been looking for when I went through that. But, there are a whole lot of things that I have to look for when I grade, for example, an offensive line play.
Yeah.
And it already requires, let's see, a typical game will have about 60 plays and it will take maybe about 2.5 minutes per play. So that would be 60 times 2.5, 150, 2.5 hours. That's like perfect. That would be right on schedule for what we take. So at 2.5 minutes per play, we're spending 30 seconds trying to figure out in each case, the lineman, what that block was. Was he doing what he's supposed to be?
Right.
Did he miss some assignment that he might've been? Is there any post-play emoting that is giving away what the group is supposed to do kind of thing? So, watching the All-22, if I were to give it the kind of degree, the kind of analysis that I would give the offensive line, it requires a much larger effort than I have done to date. I'll say that.
No, I didn't intend any criticism of that. It's just something that I would like to know, but haven't looked for.
No, that's fair enough. One of the other things is just that when I got interested in this originally, I kind of used the same principle I talked about earlier, that I really wanted to do something different that nobody else had been doing. And nobody had participation by play at the time. Now everybody's got it, but at the time, nobody had it. And that was really different from the defense. It allowed me to come up with all kinds of weird combination statistics that people didn't have. And the other thing was to do offensive line scoring because no one was doing anything with that. So, that was those are two cool things to do. Now there's a lot of people who try to do more with offensive line play. Let's put it that way. There's a lot of people who watch film on offensive line play and want to tell you about individual plays. There's fewer people that actually do any sort of scoring metric for it, but there's pass rush win weight and there's PFF stats and there's other things. It's still individual enough to me that I want to continue to do it. But at some point, I'll probably give it up if there are a lot of other people trying to do the same thing. Yeah,
I always assumed, and this is a statement, but it's meant to be a question. I always assumed that you began the offensive line scoring as a way to teach yourself about offensive line play, you know, to kind of pick up on what they're doing. Oh, I'll score it, and the attention that I paid to scoring it will teach me, you know, I'll educate myself in the process.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's certainly an element of that in anything. And in particular, like understanding what the packages and alignments were on defense very much wanted exactly that. And some of it is just, you want to be able to describe the game in a certain way, mm-hmm. to people around you at your seats, to talk to anybody who you might be sitting with at home watching the game on a Sunday. And just that's a, you know, interest. That's the way I like to focus on the game. In terms of the offensive line play, you're absolutely right. It was in part to teach. And then the really long thing, the thing that's had the system evolve a lot over the years is in getting the weights right. And yeah. I think I'm convinced that that's where the real magic is. I think that, you know, basically PFF and other people who watch film regularly and me would sit down and we'd have the same direction, you know, a plus or minus on every single play or very close to every play.
Yep.
And
yep.
Definitional might have some changes, but the weights are where the magic is. The weights are where you have to get it right. And I still think I'm doing something in that space that's different from a lot of the other people.
I mean, fractional sacks all by itself is worth something. Fractional pressure.
Who doesn't want to know about 0.17 sacks? That, you know.
Okay, there is a skill position player I would like to ask you about.
Sure.
And it is the absent but not forgotten Keaton Mitchell. And I have two questions for you. And the first is, could you explain to me again, which you did the last time I was on a podcast with you, why he has been a game day inactive? I know so that's number one. And number two, is he going to play against Kansas City?
So I don't think he's going to play against Kansas City. I think Harbaugh has kind of already feels like he's addressed it. And I think he's almost got to the point where he doesn't want the question to come up anymore. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he'll even say, you know, I really appreciate the question, but here's how we evaluate this kind of thing. But he's the first time to say, I really appreciate the question. Here's how we evaluate. The second time is, yeah, I really appreciate that question, but here's how we evaluate. The third thing, you're going to get something more firebrandy and salty. I think he feels like the question is asked and answered at this point. I don't think his original answer was very good. So I think, you know, he changed that to be.
I want your answer, not Harbaugh's answer.
Okay. So my answer is I want to see him in there. And I think,
but who is it? Rasheen Ali, who's keeping Keaton Mitchell on the bench, or is it somebody else?
Okay. So since I think it's a mistake, it's going to be hard for me to recreate somebody else's thinking on exactly this, but In the case of Keaton Mitchell, I think it is either something we are not privy to at practice. Maybe he's put the ball on the ground twice.
Okay.
You know, I wouldn't want to know that were true. I wouldn't. I hope that is not true. But maybe there's been something.
So some kind of doghouse issue in practice.
Yeah. It could have been a work ethic. Could have been late for meetings. Could have been a lot of things.
Okay.
So there are certainly things that happen behind the scenes, as we know, with players like McKinney and Gaither and, you know, guys a long time ago, you know, significant talent, but really tossed it away in terms of their inability to stay focused on the game. So I think that's possible. I don't really believe Keaton Mitchell's kind of a lifer in this game. He's got his dad to tell him the right things on a week to week basis. If he's
not only that, but the work ethic to do that rehab from a gruesome injury like that is tremendous. We have no concept of how much work that is.
Yeah.
So I would have trouble believing that there's a work ethic issue.
I would too. And so now we're down to just like his utility on the field. So I look at the snaps for Rasheen Ali, and I was looking at the Cleveland game, and he had 15 snaps, and 7 of those 15 special team snaps. Let me be careful about that. 7 of his 15 special team snaps were kickoff returns that Mitchell would have been a 1-for-1 substitution for him. Mm-hmm. And I probably would say a slightly better 1-for-1 substitution. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's not a lot of difference between the two, but I believe he'd be slightly better. I thought we saw a little bit more from him, and the two big returns that Ali has had, in both cases, I'd say his speed ended up being a slight detriment to the length of the run. Both were well blocked. Both were cases, one in the preseason, one during the regular season against the Lions here, were cases where he had a good long run back. At both times, I believe the kicker either made the tackle or slowed him down enough for somebody else to make the tackle. And that was the case in the Dallas game. So those were two cases where I think, you know, Mitchell's additional pop might have been something that would help. They might not kick it to Mitchell, by the way, if you're on the field.
True.
So that, you know, that's always something. But that's the first part. The second part is what does he provide you on special teams that are snaps where Mitchell might not play? And the answer is that Ali played 8 snaps in that Cleveland game. That it's a variety of other units, you know, a kickoff coverage unit and I think he might have played a punt return unit as well, too, where he might have been a jammer.
Okay.
On the outside. So it's those kind of things. It's not valueless, but I have to run that up first against what Mitchell would provide you offensively. Ali played 1 snap of offense, I believe, yep, against Cleveland, and he had 1 carry. And I may be misthinking that. Maybe he did that in the Buffalo game, but I think it might have been the Cleveland game. So he had 1 carry. So that has some value, but I got to believe Mitchell is going to be much more valuable in terms of what you'd see offensively. And I think you'd see him for more plays than that. And then the third domino in this is Justice Hill. Okay, so the team has decided they want to have Justice Hill on passing downs a lot of the time, but there's other times when they have Justice Hill on the field for, say, a 2nd-and-10 play. And I think Mitchell can do you a lot of good on such plays, misdirecting the defense, and I think they have to completely respect that, whether or not he gets the ball. He's already proven to be a very explosive guy with the ball in his hands, certainly as a runner, but also with the ball in his hands as a receiver. In the preceason and
murderous in the screen, yeah, game, just lethal.
Yeah. So 1 catch for 28 yards last year when everything was wrong physically with him. So he's been a guy I think they can get value out of that way. And if you do that, once some of Justice Hill's snaps are being taken away from him as a running back, then you can move Justice Hill back to special teams. He didn't play there in 24, but I doubt he's anything but one of the team's best special teams players still.
Yeah.
And I think he could go back and do that. And then once you have that, I don't think you need Rasheen Ali anymore for the marginal value of his snaps. I don't think you've got a better play in Ali than Hill as a special teamer, which would be the argument. And I don't think you have as good a package of offensive plays either. So that would be the long argument. I've done that. I apologize to the listeners. I've done that a couple times already on the show, but
sorry, guys.
You know, it is something worth discussing.
I agree with you completely. And so this is, so I, you know, I'm maybe in the minority among some Ravens fans in that I think that John Harbaugh is a tremendous coach. And I think that he does a great job in general of analyzing like roster activations and, you know, the appropriate number of bodies accorded to special teams and all the rest of that stuff. But I think he's missing the boat here. And one of the ways I think he's missing the boat here is that the idea that the offense would be limited with Keaton Mitchell on the field, I don't recall it being limited in 2023 when Keaton Mitchell was on the field. He could, you know, run it. He could catch. He's probably not as good at identifying his pass blocking responsibilities as, say, a Justice Hill is, but he can pick that up. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It seems a big miss to me. But as you say, maybe he's fumbling in practice or something. Like maybe there's more to the story than we know.
You've got this amazing fresh legs offense as it stands right now, where you've got a whole bunch of different people subbing in, and the subs like Hopkins and Walker are making big plays.
Yep.
I think that defenses, particularly if the Ravens started to elevate their snap count and start winning some snap count games, mm-hmm, which I sure as hell hope that's going to happen sometime this year.
Right.
Because if it doesn't, the Ravens probably will not even make the playoffs, would be my guess. If they fail to, you know, win snap count some appreciable number of the remaining games, I think they could well fail to make the playoffs. Mitchell would be, I think, a big asset for that as another pair of fresh legs.
Yeah.
As another guy who would then be, you know, one deeper. And there,
another wave of attackers.
Another wave. I look at that as a lot like having a very deep bullpen of guys you can bring in to make things happen. And, you know, the defenders already have their hands on their hips, and Keaton Mitchell comes in all spry to line up either in the as a flanker or in the backfield, either one. And, you know, they won't be shaking their heads because they don't want to show it, but they'll be thinking, oh crap. And especially if they know he's getting the football since he's coming to the game. All right, Jim, always a pleasure talking football with you, my friend.
Same.
Tell folks where they can find your work online on your Substack and also contact you with a question if they have it.
Right. So my Substack is Zip Drive and Dish. I also almost weekly put kind of a teaser for that article on the RSR forum. On the RSR website. Tony L has been very gracious about that. And then you can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky. I'm always, I don't know, probably 75% of the time liking the stuff that Ken posts on Twitter. So you can just look at his likes and you can find me there. And and that's where I am.
Do you wish that Twitter had a downvote system the way Reddit does? Reddit, you know, there's a bunch of ruthless downvoters out there. Most people, they see good content, they want to upvote most things.
Yeah.
But I'll either upvote it or not vote it. Those are my two choices. I won't ever downvote anything anybody says. People are expressing their opinions. They want to vent. They're angry about Lele without good reasons. They love some player that I don't like to the sky. I can't think of exactly who that would be, but right. if there was such a player, no problem. I'm not going to respond to it. I'm not going to downvote it, but I will upvote a lot of things. So I use the Twitter methodology, but Twitter even more, I use a like as I hear your comment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't necessarily agree with it, but I hear your comment.
So among the things that I wish were different about Twitter, probably the top 5 or 10 are political and maybe uh-huh. don't belong on your podcast. So I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, fair enough. And I know a lot of people are in your boat with that. I hope it can remain a relatively safe and unfettered space for sports fans.
Yeah.
We can still talk our common language there, whatever. People's political beliefs are, and I do not bring that onto this show or really in anything I do. Anyway, Jim, really appreciate having you on. Other folks out there who are listening, thank you very much for continuing to be fans of the show. I know this goes long and in season, particularly after a tough loss like this, not always the thing you want to listen to, but thanks for hanging in there for the full 2 hours. Jim, thanks again for coming on.
Ken, thank you.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
There's nothing like being in the stands cheering on your favorite team. GameTime is your hack to unlocking amazing tickets in just a few taps. Plus, their GameTime guarantee means you can trust you'll get 100% authentic tickets at the best price. Fees are always included, so what you see is what you pay. Get the best deals on sports tickets. Download the GameTime app and create an account to start searching for tickets to upcoming games and events. Swipe, tap, ticket, go. GameTime.